Case number 12-1040, Khadija Duma, Appellant v. Commissioner of Internal Revenue Service. Ms. Lundy for the amicus curiae, Ms. Bradley for the appellee.
May it please the Court, my name is Rochelle Lundy and I represent the amicus curiae appointed on behalf of the appellant. I'd also like to reserve 1 minute of my time for rebuttal. This case presents an issue of first impression for this Court, whether a premature notice of appeal from a tax court decision can be considered timely under Appellate Rule 13. The federal courts have long recognized that premature notices of appeal from civil and criminal decisions should be permitted to ripen upon the entry of a final judgment and be considered timely. Appellants from the tax court should be afforded that same protection. More specifically, the premature notice of appeal filed here by Ms. Duma should be considered to have ripened upon the tax court's entry of its final judgment and be deemed timely for the following three reasons. First, federal appellate courts not only have the equitable authority to allow premature notices of appeal to ripen, they have recognized that doing so, in fact, promotes the purpose of the federal rules. Second, the test set out by the Supreme Court in the first-year case, which applies to premature notices of appeal brought from civil and criminal decisions, also supports allowing Ms. Duma's notice to ripen. And third, turning to the merits of Ms. Duma's case, she's presented genuine issues for appeal here, as the record reflects that the tax court made reversible errors in its determination of her liability for tax penalties. Turning to the first point, the court should use its equitable authority to construe Rule 13 to permit Ms. Duma's premature notice of appeal from the tax court to have ripened upon the entry of the tax court's final judgment. Allowing Ms. Duma's notice of appeal to ripen in this case would be consistent with federal appellate court's practice of interpreting Appellate Rule 4, which governs appeals from civil and criminal cases, to permit ripening even before it was amended to expressly include that clarification. Although there was no express provision for ripening in pre-amendment Rule 4, courts routinely consider premature notices timely, and they cited the purpose of the federal rules and the strong preference for decisions on the merits rather than dismissals pursuant to procedural or technical errors. Rule 13 should now be read here in the same way. The same factors that motivated the courts to read pre-amendment Rule 4 apply here with equal force. First, hearing the merits of Ms. Duma's appeal would support the purpose of the federal rules, as well as the procedural rules that govern the tax court, which contains similar provisions favoring decisions on the merits. There also would not be any prejudice here to the opposing party. With premature notices, as the Supreme Court held in the Lemke case, the appellee is on notice of the intent to appeal, and thus the opposing party is not caught off guard. The appellee here received Ms. Duma's premature notice and was undoubtedly made aware of her intent to appeal the tax court's determination of her liability for tax penalties and tax deficiency.
The amount of the liability was not determined at the time the notice of appeal was filed.
The precise amount that she would owe to the commissioner following the conclusion of the case was not determined.
Under the interpretations that you rely upon of Appellate Rule 4 before the amendment, the courts held that if the amount of the liability is not determined at the time the premature notice of appeal is filed, it's not effective.
The cases from the pre-amendment Rule 4 cases?
Right.
Yeah, because there was no real judgment. There was nothing to appeal from. It wasn't final.
That's correct, that in this case, this was not a final judgment of
but
the tax.
But I mean, it was beyond not final. I mean, it was just completely incomplete. You can have a not final issuance that is just a mini step away from final, and everything is there. But everything was far from being here in this case.
In this case, the only thing that remained to be determined was the precise amount that Ms. Duma would owe to the commissioner at the conclusion of the case. Her liability for the particular tax penalties at issue had been determined, and the amount of her taxable income, the deficiency that she owed to the IRS, had been determined at that time. And in this case, the computation phase involved only a straightforward calculation pursuant to the statutory rate at which the penalties are.
Was there an agreement between the parties under Rule 155?
There was no, the tax court ordered that computations be submitted by the parties pursuant to Rule 55. And in this particular case, Ms. Duma did not enter a computation and did not oppose the computation that was offered by the government. And so that was submitted to the tax court. The tax court included it in its final decision and entered that judgment.
How much was it? What was the amount again?
The amount of the deficiency or the?
Yeah.
I believe the deficiency is approximately $19,000. I'd have to check to get the exact figures for you. And the deficiencies are a few thousand dollars each.
In the cases where this equitable discretion to allow a premature notice to ripen, the courts have usually had a circumstance where the decision would be immediately appealable if it was followed by entry of judgment. And I think what the court is asking you here is, why should we do that in this case where there was something left to be determined?
I think although there was something left to be determined in this case, it was something that was of such a straightforward nature that it's comparable to those situations where the decision merely needed to be entered. And in fact, there is a pre-amendment Rule 4 case that's a very similar posture to this one. It's the Curtis Gallery case that's cited on page 22 of our brief. And there the court considered a case that had been determined by the district court but was brought under the tax code. This was a pre-amendment Rule 4 case from the Ninth Circuit. And it, in fact, found in that case that although the appellants had filed their notice of appeal at the same point as Ms. Duma filed her notice here, after liabilities had been determined but prior to the computation being made, that notice of appeal could ripen, and it, in fact, took into account the petitioner's pro se status, which, again, mirrors this case. And in that particular case, it ended up actually taking over a year for the amount of the computation to be finalized prior to their notice of appeal being filed, and the court still considered that notice could ripen upon the eventual entry of the final judgment. And that's consistent with the Supreme Court's...
May I ask you, there's a new Rule 13 that's supposed to take effect December 1st, 2013. What's the difference between the old rule and the new rule?
To be honest with you, I'm not familiar with the content of the new Rule 13, and so I couldn't tell you.
Is this a jurisdictional requirement?
It is a jurisdictional requirement that the notice of appeal be timely. However, if a premature notice of appeal is considered to ripen upon the entry of a final judgment, it is indeed timely, and then the court can take jurisdiction of the matter.
So in your argument, you just want to ignore what she did much later. Don't count any of that. You want to rest on what she initially did, which before there was any kind of final judgment. You don't want us to look at what she did well many months later in trying to file an appeal. Your theory is based on let's rely on what she did early, even though there was no judgment that was discernible at that point.
Yes, our argument is that the premature notice that she filed should be allowed to ripen. And you're correct that she did indeed file a notice much later on in the case after the time to appeal had expired. However, the reason she did that is that she did not receive the notification from the tax court indicating that her original premature notice was not effective. And so when she followed up with the court to check on the status of her case, she learned that that notice had not been effective, and she immediately filed a subsequent notice seeking to appeal her case, as she had not previously been aware that her premature notice hadn't been considered effective by the court.
You say there's some current case addressing the existing rules in which a party has prematurely attacked something that's not a final judgment, and that was allowed to satisfy the jurisdictional appeal requirement?
There was a case from the pre-amendment Rule 4 cases.
Not since, right?
Since there have been cases where there have been issues to have been determined following a final judgment. For instance, in this circuit, it's limited to cases in which there were claims brought by different parties or different claims on which judgment had not been entered, the Outlaw case and the Capital Sprinkler case. However, in other circuits, the notices of appeal have been allowed to ripen, even where damages or fees or costs remain to be determined. And so those cases do exist in the post-amendment interpretation of Rule 4.
Would your argument be the same if there was if the computation amount was contested?
If the computation amount was contested, that would present a more difficult situation, a more difficult argument for allowing Ms. Duma's notice to ripen. In this case, however,
how do we know whether, if this appeal is allowed, how do we know that she's not going to contest the computation of the deficiency?
It's correct that there's no way to know if she would attempt to do that. However, given that her notice was filed subsequent only to the determination of her liabilities and the amount of her deficiency, this notice of appeal could be allowed to go forward in such a way that she would only be allowed to contest
those issues. But we don't know. There's no way that we can tell that the computation is going to be contested or not contested, even though she didn't participate in it. You never know.
That's true. There's no way to know for certain whether or not she would have contested the computation. However, she hasn't filed anything indicating that she has since contested that computation.
Changed her reasons for why she has filed late? Initially, she was claiming she owed nothing, and later she said she should be excused because of a disability, right?
I believe that she's alleged both of those things. She has, looking at the merits of her case, her initial testimony to the tax court was that she had indeed filed her taxes,
right,
and did not owe any taxes,
right,
to the IRS. We have subsequently made the argument that the tax court made reversible errors in its determination of her liability for penalties by not considering the disability that she raised at the tax court level as a reasonable excuse exception to those penalties. In the determination of her liability for tax penalties, the tax court overlooked the fact that disability can satisfy the reasonable cause exception over Section 6651, and there's also a statutory exception under Section 6654 that provides an exception for individuals who've recently become disabled. And the tax court did not address either of those in its decision, and we would ask that this court remand the case to the tax court in order that it determine those issues. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Janet Bradley, and I represent the Commissioner of Internal Revenue in this appeal. The threshold question before this court is whether or not it has jurisdiction over this appeal. And I want to clarify here, it's an appeal from a decision of the tax court. This court has jurisdiction over appeals from decisions of the tax court pursuant to Internal Revenue Code Provision 7482. The decision for purpose of a tax court case is really a term of art, and I think part of the appellant or the amicus argument is confusing between terms that are used in district court cases and district court appeals versus here where we have a tax court case and a tax court appeal. Section 7459C of the code provides that a decision is rendered upon the date that an order specifying the amount of the deficiency is entered. Jurisdiction for purposes of this court is also contingent upon the taxpayer filing a timely notice of appeal. Here the taxpayer filed two so-called notices of appeal. One she filed coincidentally on the date that her computation of damages was due to the tax court, and then she subsequently filed one 14 months after the decision had been entered. The amicus has not made any argument that the notice of appeal that was filed in January of 2012 is timely, and we submit it's quite clear that it's in excess of the 90-day period to appeal, and the court doesn't have jurisdiction. Amicus' argument really hinges on the effect of a document that Ms. Duma filed Again, coincidentally, on the date the Rule 155 computations were due to the tax court. The tax court had entered its opinion in December of 2009, and because of various concessions both by the commissioner and by Ms. Duma, you know, there was no way to exactly determine what exactly the liabilities for the deficiencies for the 2 years at issue or what the computations of the additions to tax for failure to file, failure to pay, and failure to pay estimated tax. So the tax court, as it does routinely in cases like this, and it said at the end of its opinion, it directed that its decision would be withheld pending the 155 computations. The commissioner prepared 155 computations. They were served on the taxpayer here, Ms. Duma, and in addition, the tax court routinely will send those along to the taxpayer.
Where is the document that she filed on the day that the Rule 155 computation was?
That is in the appendix. That, I believe, was filed as docket entry page 153. It's actually captioned in the docket sheet. It was captioned as a motion to enlarge time and in the alternative for a notice of appeal. Ms. Duma essentially was asking the tax court to have more time, apparently, to address her deficiencies and the additions to tax here after the tax court had been very patient with her, allowing continuances, allowing her more time, having phone conversations with her and counsel for the commissioner.
That decision from that for the first decision from the tax court, if I recall correctly, I think you just said this, on its face was conditional, right?
And this I'll get back to the terminology. The first entry was a memorandum opinion that was entered by the tax court. The tax court is required as a threshold matter to have findings of fact or an opinion, and that's also in IRC 7459. After the opinion, then the tax court at the conclusion said that it was going to withhold its decision
right.
Pursuant to Rule 155.
That's what I'm saying. That it was clear that this was not a final judgment.
It was clear. And I would only suggest the amicus frames this as some novel appellate question, and the government would submit that, on the contrary, that the statutes are so clear as to what happens in the tax court that it's only filing after a decision. The statute 7483 says the appeal must be filed within 90 days after.
Now, what are you saying about the incorporation of principles from Rule 4? Are you implicit in your argument saying that we cannot or should not in this case even think about it? What is your argument?
Our argument is that this court should not and need not even look to Rule 4.
Because
Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 14 specifically talks about what rules in the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure and Appellate Procedure are applicable to the tax court. And it specifically says that Rule 4 does not apply to the tax court.
You want to be under Rule 13, period.
We want to be, exactly. Rule 13, the language.
There are no other rules in this case as far as you're concerned.
No, there are no other rules, and that's actually typically the beauty of an appeal from a tax court decision. My office obviously handles appeals from district court, and the jurisdictional issues can get muddy at times. Here, it's quite plain that the decision had not been entered, and to the extent Ms. Duma was claiming some prejudice from not receiving the tax court's order stating that her appeal was premature, you know, it really doesn't matter because, in fact, here, the decision, she's never claimed that the decision that was duly entered by the tax court determining the amount of her deficiencies and the additions to tax for 2003 and 2004. So once she received that decision, she had every opportunity to to file a notice of appeal.
What prejudice is there to the commissioner if this, if the notice of appeal that she filed after the decision is treated as sufficient?
The prejudice to the commissioner is in the whole statutory scheme of tax court's decisions.
You don't want to be in the Rule 4 realm.
Yeah, well, that's one of them. The other rule is Internal Revenue Code Provision 7491, which provides that if a timely notice of appeal, that's one that isn't filed within 90 days after the decision, that is the statutory finality of the tax court's decision. That is it. And if Ms. Duma filed a timely of appeal, she could have posted a bond that would have precluded the commissioner from actually collecting her liability. But the fact of the matter is, once that decision became statutorily final pursuant to that internal code statute, the IRS can go collect. So it really gets to Congress wanting to have an orderly administration of the tax laws. Obviously, the taxpayers have their opportunities to go through the channels to contest their liability, additions to tax. And here
so
we...
She filed a timely notice of appeal with the clerk of the tax court. What does the clerk of the tax court do with that?
Once the notice of appeal is filed and she pays the docketing fee, that would be transmitted to this court. And she has an opportunity, once she files that notice of appeal, to stay the collection of her tax. She could post a bond. So that's her protection in case she prevails. And alternatively,
does the clerk of the court issue instructions to the taxpayer that you have to file the record and you have to post a bond in the amount of the deficiency?
I don't believe the tax court clerk or people case manager actually will sit down with any litigant, be them represented or pro se, and go over the entire procedure. Pro se litigants have an obligation to, you know, apprise themselves of the court's rules, and even this court, I think on its webpage, has a segment that kind of helps pro ses along.
The notice of appeal does not automatically stay the judgment of the tax court?
No. The notice of appeal does not automatically stay that unless she posts a bond. And the commissioner sometimes, as a practical matter, if the taxpayer has a legitimate dispute and we're not bumping up against any statute of limitations for purposes of assessment and collection, we may sometimes just hold off, you know, in good faith, but absolutely not. We could have collected her liability.
So the answer to my question, initial question about what prejudice is, that it isn't ease of administration, is upset if appellate rule 13 is interpreted in the manner that the amicus is advocating.
Well, it's that and the fact for all taxpayers, I mean, what the rules are, and, you know, Congress has an interest in protecting the public fisc and the Treasury and the collection of taxes that it deems properly due.
There's a line in Pickwick Papers that captures your position. It's called rules is rules.
Yes, rules.
Well, you know, and rules are good because then everybody knows what they are. It's clear. There hasn't been any litigation of premature appeals spawned as a result of this.
But the taxpayer doesn't have to post a bond, correct?
No, she doesn't.
I mean, she could go forward with the tax, and she could go forward with the appeal, right?
Right.
In that case, if she doesn't do it timely, she's probably lost the opportunity to post the bond, so it really doesn't affect your collection at all, does it?
Well, it could in the sense that, you know, sometimes taxpayers might have their assets go in different directions, so actually the government may not collect. The more time that goes on, sometimes.
Yeah, but I'm saying if she doesn't post the bond, you just collect, right? I mean,
absolutely.
So the appeal doesn't affect that.
No, it does not affect that. But again, Ms. Duma could have posted a bond, which would have prohibited us from collecting. And here, let me just also point out, as to the underlying liability, amicus is not challenging the liability at all. Here, Ms. Duma, in fact, admitted that for the first year, 2003, that she had received the slightly more than $93,000 in wages from Fannie Mae. And for the second year, she admitted the wages, and there was little dispute over how much of the stock sale proceeds she had received. But Ms. Duma had ample opportunity. Judge Gustafson really tried to help her at every opportunity to give her suggestions what she could bring to court. And the simple fact of the matter is she brought no documentation.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Ms. Lundy, we'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you. I just wanted to quickly touch on a few points that came up during the appellee's argument. First, as she explained to you, the term decision is a term of art in the tax court, and it obviously has a specific meaning there that may not be obvious even to attorneys working on the civil and criminal side. And that's actually all the more reason that in this case, a pro se appellant like Ms. Duma should be granted additional leeway in recognizing when is the appropriate time to appeal from the tax court decision. The decision she appealed from here operated as a final determination on her liability for those tax penalties, even if the amount itself wasn't entered. And it's understandable, as you just heard, with such a complicated scheme in the tax court, that she was confused about what the appropriate time to appeal. I also just wanted to touch on the prejudice to the commissioner in this situation. As was just discussed, the prejudice that's being alleged here is more concerned with finality and administration than it is prejudice and harm. And this isn't the sort of prejudice that's relevant under the analysis that's taken place in determining whether premature notices of appeal should ripen. That sort of prejudice is whether the appellee was caught off guard, was caught by surprise by the fact of the appeal itself, and there hasn't been any allegation that's occurred here.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lundy. We know that you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant, and we thank you for your assistance.
Thank you.
And we're going to do something a little different here, which is ask the government's counsel to return for a moment.
I want to make sure I understand the sweep of your argument. If the petitioner here had filed a paper at the same time sequence, but the paper said, I don't care what your determination is on the numbers, do your thing, I'm appealing. I'm not liable for anything. So I don't care about the calculation, that's why I'm not submitting anything. I am not liable for anything. And I'm appealing. Why shouldn't that be allowed to write?
We're dealing with statutory provision in Section 7482. This court has jurisdiction over to review decisions of the tax court. And a notice of appeal, 7483, it's statutory, so Congress has specified that a notice of appeal must be filed within 90 days after entry of the decision. If the rules here are not in the tax court what they are in the district court. In the district court, this court's appellate jurisdiction is typically under 28 U.S.C. 1291. And there's always the question arose years ago, and that amendment that was in Rule 4 was back in 1979. Obviously, there's been no need to change that statutory provision in over 30 years. We need to have some orderly administration. And so what would happen then if the taxpayer filed a petition and alternatively for a notice of appeal that she was going to contest regardless what the tax court did? I mean, it's really going to be somewhat problematic if things
don't... You're saying there are no equitable notions that can come
in. No, there's... the tax court is an Article
I'm not talking
court.
About her later filing, which is clearly way, way out of time. I'm talking about the first one. If she simply says, no matter what determination you make, I'm appealing because I'm not liable to anything.
Well, and that could happen in a district court case. I mean, that could happen in any case that, you know, well, I'm, as a litigant, not going to accept if I have any adverse judgment, decision, order against me. I mean, I think that would be a little disruptive to the whole judicial process. And again, here she had the opportunity. And Ms. Duma, as we kind of detail in a lengthy footnote, Ms. Duma's been before this court on numerous occasions. I think she's filed three or four other appeals involving Fannie Mae, so she obviously was just not... she was a pretty seasoned litigant. She understood notices of appeal, and here she had a duty to monitor the tax court's docket. Pro se or not, there's the rules. The tax court has nice guides that help explain to pro se litigants, you know, what they need to do. And,
you know, what happened to her? Did the tax court judge act on her motion for an extension of time?
The tax court on the premature notice that was filed 2 months before the decision, within, I think it was June 28th, her premature notice, I believe, was June 22nd or June 23rd, had in fact issued an order first addressing her motion to the extent it could be construed as a motion to reconsider the tax court's opinion. The court said, you know, look, I've given you ample opportunity. Years and years have gone by. It's way too late now to go ahead and file a motion to reconsider. And again, a motion to reconsider should be filed within 30 days after the opinion. She simply did not abide by that rule. She waited about 6 months, which coincidentally, again, was the date her Rule 155 computations were due. And so she first filed the motion to reconsider, and the tax court said, at this juncture, you haven't provided me with any evidence of anything that there's anything amiss with what was found in the court's opinion. And she alternatively said notice of appeal, and the tax court did address that and said it was premature because it wasn't entered after the court had made an actual decision as to her specific liabilities.
Okay. Thank you.